Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
if I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Blowing up Big Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howe. Andrew on the board. SP Futures down 42. NASDAQ Futures down 225. Let's see what we did yesterday as a way to compare. Yesterday, we were down a little bit, but Monday we were up a bunch. So we're now probably maybe even for the week here, maybe still a little up. But the big news last night was Tesla's down $21 as they missed. Google missed as well. They're only down 660, 3%. Tesla's down 9. Do we have Kevin?
Good morning.
How are you?
Well, I'm doing all right.
Well, telephone had earnings too. They're up 46 cents, not so much, but they don't move all that much usually on earnings. I mean, well, of course, when you get a stock that low, 46 cents is a lot. Just yesterday, for those that keep your eye on some stocks, I always keep an eye on UPS because traditionally we've had a lot of people UPS stock here at PTI. UPS is one of the, I don't know how many, well, Kevin, how many companies you think are still like this that are a real appreciable amount of their retirement money is in their own stock. Bear Stearns, unfortunately, was clearly like that. And UPS has been like that. I mean, there's people, this is, you know, just going back a ways, but we had several clients from UPS that retired from there. Now, you know, most of them are dead, but unfortunately. But they retired from UPS, and the numbers seem to be $1.2 million, $1.3 million if you worked there pretty much your whole career. And that was your, was some kind of a pension plan, but it was pretty much all in UPS stock. And then when you left, we had, it was like an A shares, and we had to change the B shares, or they were B shares, we had to change it to A shares somehow, you know. But we had took, it was a kind of an episode to get it out of there. And if you took your stock out of the plan before you retired, boy, it was like it was like you farted in church, for God's sake. I mean, they didn't want any. You, it was like a, you know, a total mutiny on your loyalty to the place. So like nobody did that, and you know, I think the stack when we got it, the first person had to be 60, you know, 50, and it went from there pretty much by starts and stops up to about 208, and to the last year, last 3 or 4 years, we. This is when people fight. This is a probably is, well, I guess I can tell a story about not fighting. We had a bunch of UPS stock from a person who was not doing very well. You know, and so we protected it, but because their basis was so low, we really couldn't sell any calls, but. So we get the stock, and it's about 208, and it goes down to about 135. So, you know, they should have lost. Well, should have lost. They would have lost, like, you know, four something, high 400,000s. And because we had some put protection and did some, you know, pretty good put trading along the way, they maybe were down, you know, 150 or something, which is pretty darn good. Maybe 180. So we managed to. Take care of two-thirds of it, because all the stock did was go straight down. I mean, it was pretty awful. Now, of course, it pays a nice dividend, so you got some of that back. But then the lady dies, right? And all of a sudden, you know, now when somebody dies, somebody's power of attorney goes, so we can't do any trading anymore. And the stock was supposed to be split up between, like, three people, with the taxes the way it is, and I'm no tax guy, but if you give somebody stock, if Grandpa O'Neill was still alive and croaked and had, 1,000 shares of IBM from $5 or something, now it's 183, and he gives it to you through the will, your new basis is 183. Like, nobody ever pays that tax there. It's like, because all the rich people are always complaining about, it may not be rich, could be somebody who just happens to have stock. But anybody who complains about there's not, all they do is pay taxes and the poor people don't pay them. Nobody ever pays that tax. So anyway, the group gets into a big fight in probate, so they never split the stock up. Yet, there's nothing I can do to protect it. And yesterday's stock's down $20. And I'm like, what? That's what you get for fighting like a bunch of idiots, right, Kevin? It's like, what are you doing? Anyway, how's that for a story?
Greed has a tendency to bite the greedy person in the butt.
Yeah, and it's we're talking about in the Chicago area. I mean, Mike, I don't know if you're familiar, but UPS in Chicago is a huge center for UPS people. So I'm going to say the amount of UPS stock in the Chicago area is pretty dramatic. So even though nobody worries about UPS stock anymore, that kind of stuff happens. I mean, one of the things that I, being in this business, and one of the hardest things that happens is if somebody comes over to you and says, here's my 15 stocks, what do you think? And you go, what do you mean, what do I think? Well, do you think this is a good one or a bad one? Blah, blah, blah. I don't know that anybody can sit there and have a knowledge of every individual stock, whether the chairman is stealing or whether, God knows what could be happening. That's why you like to diversify. That's why I like to stay in, the ETFs. It's much easier for me, if somebody doesn't have a bunch of stock, to put somebody in the queues. It's not easier for me, but you get instant diversification in the S&P and the queues. Of course, now all the indexes move differently, so it's a little more difficult. But still, you don't get that single company risk where, you have 10 companies, all of a sudden one of them. But I always wonder, Kevin and Mike, how I dodged the bullet back in 2007. I never had anybody show up, my brother or I, and somebody opens up their portfolio and go, well, hey, we got Bear Stearns, Sears, Kmart, General Motors, United Airlines, and you're sitting there going, oh, that looks pretty good to me, because that would have been a very usual Chicago portfolio, because United Airlines is a hometown airline, Sears is a hometown company, Kmart, they're not hometown here, but they came from, what were they? They were the guys from Minnesota, right? What was the company before them?
Before Kmart? Oh, yeah. Geez, I don't know.
It was they were somebody else, some other discount chain became Kmart or something. Anyway, it's distant history. But if somebody would have come to you with their portfolio, you said, or Citigroup, looks pretty good to me, or GE. I mean, we're talking about GE damn near went out of business. General Motors did, right? Went bankrupt. United went bankrupt. Sears went bankrupt. What if somebody had that in a portfolio and they came in and said, hey, Mike Murphy, what do you think of this portfolio? Looks good to me. 2 years later, they're all toast. How would you like that one, Mike?
That definitely wouldn't be a good thing, Tom. That's for sure.
Yeah, I was going to say, so is Mike sitting there gasping for his next breath, going, "Wait a minute, that's my portfolio."
Well, if he has Sears stock, he might as well put it on the wall in the bathroom, because it's not worth much better than that. So it's I mean, people look at the market, they forget about the companies that aren't there anymore. I mean, Citigroup, one of our best friends, by the way, his dad. Again, he'll go nameless. His dad decided, because Citigroup played such a tremendous dividend, I think he cashed out everything else in his account, and he was a pretty wealthy man, and put everything in Citigroup before 2007. And Citigroup obviously is trading higher now, but I think didn't they have a 1-for-10 reverse split or something?
To get this? I have no idea, Tom.
Well, GE did, I know for sure. I think a 1-by-10 reverse split. So don't look at the 1-to-72 now is really 17. No, so don't be fooled by the signs, Mortimer. I mean,
you make a point about. I know you watch the Russell pretty carefully and tech stocks, and now people are talking about under a Trump presidency, the Russell would go up, and under a Harris presidency, tech stocks will continue to rise. So what do you think on some of that?
Well, Mike, it's I wonder, even though the two parties and the two people, I mean, you never actually sit down and talk to them, but you just hear what the talking points. They have different policies, allegedly, right? I just wonder if both of them have not been boxed into the corner to such an extent that I don't know that there's any. What's the policy going forward? Are you going to spend even more money or tax even less? I mean, somehow or another, one of them is going to have to try and breach this 45% gap or 40% gap in what we're spending every year. And I, you know, I mean, it doesn't really matter who's there. The numbers don't lie, do they? I mean,
you're absolutely right, Tom. The spending has to be reined in. I mean, right now, the service on the debt is more than the military budget. You know, and that's kind of inexcusable.
Well, the other way to go about it is to grow, to have actual growth. And we seem, you know, unbeknownst to all this, that you know, one of the things that, you know, I've been saying, like a voice in the wilderness for so long, the growth is nowhere near where they're telling us it is because of the way they pump money into the system, the actual growth.
Tom, I agree, and the growth in the current administration is in government jobs and healthcare jobs. Well, something's got to change. We got to get manufacturing back to the States. So whoever comes up with a plan for that, you know, that would be a good thing.
Yeah, and other stuff. I mean, you guys, I mean, despite, you know, some of our different political leanings, I think you guys, we all agree on a lot of stuff. The key numbers, when you look at the employment stuff, is you got 62% of the people, essentially, that are potentially in the labor force working. And the other 38, either unemployed looking for a job or not doing something, you know, students or whatever. That number has to get, I think you just said this, Mike, without knowing it, that number needs to get to 67, 68.
I think it ought to go higher.
Well, but I mean, that's,
I guess, being realistically, you know, if we get to 70, that would be great.
Well, 70s, I'll kick it up here, but that's a massive number. I mean, because now all of a sudden you have 5% more people. I'll use the term producing rather than not producing. That'll be nice. And I don't think you can roll with it at 61, 62. Look what's happening. I mean, the thing about this is. You know, when you look at the different political parties, I'll use the term lies or falsehoods. You know, why am I being so nice? I don't know that.
Just use lies, Tom, because that's what they do.
But I mean, some of the things that you should look at that I don't know how you BS with them. I think the actual receipts from the U.S. government through taxes haven't grown squat in the last. I'm going to say, well, COVID, they sure didn't. But really, they haven't grown squat in the last 4 or 5 years. And everybody does nothing but say what a great job they did when they were president. But, I mean, the one number that can't lie is how much money they take in through taxation, right?
No, you're right. But, I mean, I know you don't think much of Kudlow, but Kudlow seems to think that the receipts have increased since the Trump tax cuts.
Well, they might have increased a little bit. But is it causative of the other? Is it causation or is it just happens? I mean, some of the people at the lower end, because of the inflation, somebody who was making 40 grand, and this is kind of the key number. We remember way back in the day when we first got out of school how I used to do some tax returns on weekends for a few extra scratcho. Well, all the different, in the Reagan administration, and he cut back on some of them, to be fair, there was a million different tax levels, right, of what you had to pay. Well, now the key one, and it's key because how many people are in this boat, when you talk about a mean salary or a mean income of people, now there's a big difference, as Kevin has brought out before. Kevin and Carl are more on this than anybody. I want you to comment on this, Kevin, please. There's a huge difference between the mean income of somebody working and the mean income of somebody who's what's the term, Kevin? Fully employed. In other words, if you're working 40 hours a week, your mean income is pushing 45, 47. If you're just a regular bloke, you're not getting the 40 hours a week. You're more like 39. Well, if you go from 40 to 50, which is where a lot of people are going, because that seems to be a big number after the, you know, with all the raises people have gotten since this inflation stuff. If you go from 40 to 50, that extra 10, you're taxed at 22% and not 12. So if you look at something like Larry Kudlow is looking at, if that's his story, he was clearly behind that tax cut no matter what. I mean, he was also...
Oh, no, I agree. Yeah. He pushes the tax cut, right?
So, but he was one of those guys that, when George Bush, right before the whole world collapsed, it was the greatest story never told in the Goldilocks economy? How the guy got a job after that, I have no idea. And he became a Council of Economic Advisors. He didn't see any of that coming, and that's his job. So I understand he's a terrific guy, and everybody likes to go over to his house, so I'd probably love him if I knew him, but... I mean, I don't know how you come back from that. The Goldilocks economy that 6 months later we almost went under. How does that work? Just saying.
Well, it doesn't work, but yeah, you're getting into a lot of things. So, you know, there's so many superficial measures of the economy. Now, when you talk about, how many people should be employed, I think that is totally a worthwhile discussion. I don't know if 67 is the right number, if it should be 70, if it should be 66. But, you know, rationally, we don't seem to be able to have conversations about what that really means. In fact, there's not very many people that even look at it. So, you know, who do you say out of the working population is not going to be employed or is likely to be out of the employment pool, and why? Well, students, yeah, a lot of students aren't in the employment pool, or they only jump into it in the summer. So, okay, we can discuss that. There are, because it starts with age 16, there's a lot of high school students that don't work. But then, like all data, it should be leading us to ask questions. Questions like, why aren't high school kids working? Are we, at least in some states, are we pricing them out of the employment market so they're not working? Okay, that's a good question. Oh, in California, how many people are hiring fast food high school workers if they have to pay them 20 bucks an hour? They're not productive at 20 bucks an hour. So that's that piece of it. But then you start talking about, well, median income is worthwhile, or any kind of average is worthwhile, but that's not a real indicator. The variance in incomes is much more important. The distribution of incomes is much more important indicator because we need to have a thriving middle class. We have to have a whole bunch of people closer to the mean, not a disparity that just happens to land at that mean.
Well, Kevin, what were the numbers here? You forced me, you two guys, the Bodie has forced me to go to the numbers, and I'll just tell you what the difference sort of means. 67. In I won't say our lifetime because we're older than this, at least you two guys are, in 2000, that number, when I'm talking about the percentage of population that are working, in 2000, that number was 64.3%, which is the highest in the last 20-some years. Okay, we're kind of stagnant at 60.1. All right, so you say, well, 3%, what the bleep? Well, in 2000, the raw numbers are there's 137 million people essentially employed, okay? There's 5.6 million unemployed, the people that are looking for work, blah, blah, blah. And there's 70 million that are students, retired, we don't know what they're doing, couch surfing.
Or in some cases are just not doing anything. And there's always going to be an element of that in the economy as well, but it's really, you know, it's the explainable ones that we need to be able to, you know, create some hypotheses about them, test it out, and see what's really going on. And nobody ever talks about
that.
Well,
I'm saying, but now those numbers today, now remember, just took the whole numbers, 137 and 70, so whatever percentage that is, somebody do the math that. Now we're 161 and 100. So we're up 25 on the working part, and we're up 30 on the not working part.
Seems to me we're losing ground.
We're absolutely losing ground. We did duck down to the lowest tick was, what year was that? 58.4 in 2011. There you go. 58.5 in 2010. So that was kind of in the middle of the recession, right? It was our lowest.
Oh,
hit.
Yeah, that was after the recession. Okay.
Yeah. So that was,
and yet through that time frame, we heard nothing about how many consecutive months of job growth we had.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Which is what, you know, which gets back to the point about, you know, are we even talking about the right statistics, let alone looking at them?
Well, I'm afeard, and I, you know, on the politics of it, the politics is going to be what it is. My fear is we're going to make it all the way to the election, and we're never going to hear anybody talk about any issue that's substantive. I think that's a real possibility, and I'm not so sure the population cares about it.
You'll hear some substantive issues. They're already harping on the border. That's a substantive issue. I don't know.
Well, I'm not saying it isn't. It clearly is, but you know, you're going to have both sides saying that the other side caused the inflation when the fact is they both did. Duh. You know, the question is not what did you do. What are you going to do to fix it? And I don't think anybody has a clue at all, either to you, on either side. I mean, is anybody saying we're going to do this with the money supply? We're going to do this with the. I mean, how are we going to close this thing in the budget? Have you heard boo on that? I haven't.
No, nobody said any. Well, actually, Robert Kennedy has talked about the national debt and how it's ballooning. So he's the only one that wants to address the debt. So
is he in any ballots?
Tom, you have talked about that. I don't know, but it's just very difficult for him to be on any ballot because of what you've discussed before. So he's probably, I think he might be on 13 states. I don't know that for a fact, but I think I've heard that.
Well, no, Kevin, you live in Michigan. I think it's easy to get on a ballot in Michigan. I seem to recall the last election.
All right, I'll sign up tomorrow.
Well, you know, I'm not so sure you can't, because the this is 4-year-old memory, which, you know, is getting tough. The last election, I actually looked at all the results by state. In some states, it was the two people and the Libertarian. Maybe there was a fourth party, but they all had some votes. I think Colorado and Michigan. I think for sure Colorado. I think you can get on if you get a parking ticket, you can get on or something. There had to be like 20 people, you know, like 50 votes. It was like Mike Murphy ran into, you got friends and family to vote for him, and they list everybody all the way down. So some states.
Wait, Mike has friends.
Well, there you go. I don't know if he's got that many in one state, but
oh, okay.
But I know a lot of people on the right are really into this states' rights stuff. I always wonder why does states determine how a national election is run? You would think that would be a national law, wouldn't you?
Well, but it's not a national election. You're electing the representatives to the Electoral College from the state, who will then go cast their votes.
Well, like I said, you would think.
Leave it to Kevin to straighten this out.
Well, I mean, there's no doubt he's right. Now the question is that anywhere near appropriate in today's world? I don't know. You know, it's whether it is or it isn't. It's not going to change. So there's no point in arguing about it. But the Nebraska, what do they do? You get every representative district, in which they don't have a whole hell of a lot. If you win the district, you win that delegate, right?
They apportion the delegates.
Based on, so Illinois would have, how many delegates you have is how many representatives you have, right? So if you win, if Trump beats Harris in Mike Quigley's district, he gets that delegate. And if Harris beats Trump in somebody else's district, she gets that delegate, I think, in Nebraska. And it might be another state or two. So, the idea of the winner take all is not, well, if you win all of them, you get all of them. But, you know, you look at the situation in Florida with the Bush-Gore thing, And I for, you know, you guys accused me of being this flaming liberal. I actually think that Nixon, not Nixon, Bush got hosed more than Gore, because I don't know if you guys remember this, gentlemen from the right, that there was a big Chad fiasco. Obviously, the
hanging Chads, dimpled Chads.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I remember them all.
But what everybody forgets, even the people on the right, I think they totally screwed Bush by you're not supposed to declare a state until the polls are closed, right? Well, the national idiots didn't realize that the panhandle is not Eastern time, it's Central time. So they called the state for Bush, right? They called it for Gore before the polls were closed. So it's always been my bet that more people in the panhandle didn't go that might have would have voted for Bush because they thought he'd already lost. It may have been more people like that.
Yeah, why would you wait in line at that point?
Yeah. So more. Well, I mean, they probably had a bunch of other people you voted for. I mean,
People who in a presidential election, most people are there primarily to vote for the.
I mean, tell you what, if they didn't
vote for everybody else.
I'll tell you what, if they didn't have a Senate race going, then I really feel the way I do, that more people stayed away than ever got screwed up with the Chads. Right? I mean, you could have. Anyway, S&P futures down 39, NASDAQ futures down 13. The big stocks moving here. Tesla, Elon Musk stock down 2090. That's 8.5%. And we've got Google's down 671, down 3.5%. Meta down $10. That's 2%. So some of those stocks are getting wagged. You know, this Tesla, I don't want to go into it. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
Low roll back stocks and jacks. I'm Tom Allen, Andrew on the board. S&P futures up, down 38. NASDAQ futures down 214. This has to do with Tesla and Google not making their numbers last night. Dow's down 146 because neither one of those are in the Dow, or else the Dow would be down a hell of a lot more. Over in Europe, got the DAX down 126, and these guys were up yesterday. It's 0.7%. FTSE, which was up and then wasn't up so much, they're only down 10.1%. CAC around, however, down 76. That's 1%. And we're going to ask Mike to comment on the political situation over there. Over in Asia, we've got these guys. Talk about crazy. You know, Nikkei down 439, 1.1%. Well under 40,000, 39,154. Hang Seng down 154.9%, 17,311. Shanghai down 13, 2901, or hanging above 2901. I'm sure Russell's going to have a lot to say about those guys. Bonds, 30-year unchanged, 4.24. The Bund unchanged, 2.43. Japan up 2 basis points, 1.08. Oil, which has been sinking, is up a little bit today, up 87 cents, 77.83, though, which is kind of the lower end of this range. Well, it's been sneakily down like 6 or 7% in the last week or two without any fanfare whatsoever. Brent up 82 cents, 81.83. Natural gas down 6 cents, 212. Arbob up 3 cents, 244. Gold up 530. Creeping back up here a little bit, 24.12. Doesn't look like it's going to make it to 24.50 anytime soon, but it's creeping a little bit. Silver up 12 cents, 29.45. Maybe it'll make it back over 30 and get whacked down again like it's had a bunch of times. Foreign exchange. The dollar is 108.3 against the euro. It's up maybe a little bit. Unchanged against the pound, 129.0. So it was going down and was going up a little bit. Now it's kind of stalled here. Crypto, after a couple of horrible days, Bitcoin's up 701, 66,430. And yesterday, again, real quick, Dow was down 57, S&P down 8, NASDAQ down 10, so not much of a day. Today's looks like it's more to the downside. We will see. Andrew, what do you got for us, Trevor Weather Sports, bud?
All right, it is 6:38 here in Chicago on Wednesday, July 24th. A little bit of sports here with some baseball. The White Sox lost to the Rangers 2-3. Brewers won over the Cubs 1-0. And the Diamondbacks won over the Royals 6-2. For weather today in Chicago, we're going to start out with a little bit of cloudy skies, possibly a little bit of showers here and there. Otherwise, skies are going to be cool. And with a little bit of sun's peeking through throughout the day, we're going to have a high of 73. We are currently at 69 right now. Over in Phoenix, hot as always. They're at 95 degrees right now. They're going to have a high of 114 today. It's going to be partly sunny and a little bit breezy. There's a blowing dust advisory, which is one I have not seen here in Chicago before. And finally, moving over to...
blowing dust. It rained last night.
Let's see. I can pull you more details.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it is that and a heat advisory, which is basically every single day. But over to Chicago traffic on the inbound expressways, we have not too much to worry about. The exception to that being on the Eisenhower East before I-294, a rolled-over semi is blocking the two right lanes. It says here it's dropped 27,000 pounds of canned goods it was carrying. But thankfully, it says solid traffic only up to about 10 minutes.
It's a lot of cans of corn, Kevin.
That is all I got. Back to you, Chief.
It's a lot of cans of corn.
Discuss some baseball stuff?
We had a trucker that overturned on one of the highways.
I know, but can of corn is a baseball expression.
So. Yeah, well, it used to be what? A grocery store expression.
Yes.
Hey,
The idea was that they. This stuff would all be up on shelves in the corner grocery store, stacked real high, and you would have you could reach up there with a hook when someone wanted a can of something off of the top shelf and just pull it down and catch it, which made the easy catch baseball expression was that it's a can of corn.
There you go. Hey, Mike,
your etymology.
Mike, I want you to use your economic background to talk about where the limit on this is. Now, Kevin is amazingly eloquent in his area of the people he teaches and the size of the industries in Michigan, Indiana, that I think still is largely working in what the three of us may consider a free economic system. Is that a fair statement, Kevin? That at some level, people have book companies,
yeah,
they have
distribution. By and large, the mid-range manufacturing distribution types of companies are, they're competitive and they're just sort of operating like a normal market in a capitalistic economy.
Yeah, you got to be careful. You can't use the market system and capitalistic system like they're synonyms these days, can you?
Yeah, I understand that.
But the other, it seems like when you go up the chain a little bit, I still think, Kevin, we could probably discuss, not argue, that I would say that their cost of capital is probably way higher than it ought to be vis-a-vis a bigger company. But let's leave that discussion for another day. I mean, Dan Janitas is always talking about that, right?
Yeah, and I agree with it, by the way.
Now the question is,
keep going.
Well, Mike brought up the idea that we need to have more manufacturing done in this country, A, just because we need people working, and B, because being able to source stuff at home is a hell of a lot safer and more secure and all those other kinds of things. But then you have the idea that some big, huge firm's going to get massive amounts of government money, not only in Wisconsin, but in Pennsylvania. And now is it Cleveland or somewhere in Ohio where somebody's getting $90 bazillion to put a chip manufacturer? Is that near Cleveland, Mike? I think it is. With this,
Columbus.
Oh, it's Columbus? Okay.
I'm sure it's Columbus.
Now all of a sudden these guys are this massive amount of government intervention and money, sort of like they're a baseball or football team, right? And I don't know how it seems like the government maybe doesn't believe in our normal system here, that those guys can't go find their own financing, they can't go out and find shareholders. I mean, the stuff that I all believe in is, how the hell do you compete with that, I guess is my question. I mean, how do you compete with the Bears if they get a new stadium, or even the rent they have in this one? I mean, why are we so anxious to take some of this stuff out of the system that we believe actually works. Do we don't believe it works, or what's the story? I'll let you talk, Mike.
Well, I think I think some of politicians are worried about, okay, our security, Taiwan makes a lot of computer chips. So Taiwan is not very secure because of the threat from China. So someone in the Biden administration or someone in the intelligence business made the determination that we need to get some chip manufacturers in the United States. And I personally agree with that. I think that's a good idea. And whether the government is forcing people to do it, I don't really care, because, we need the chips. We need more chips manufactured in the United States. We need more pharmaceuticals manufactured in the United States. And I'm sure there's other gaps where the government could at least give incentives to people to bring manufacturing back to the States.
Well, how much of it, DeBoto, you guys, how much of it, if you go buy a drug, I mean, a vitamin or whatever it is, I think all of us are at least doing the vitamin stuff. The stuff that's made here is going to be more expensive because, maybe because of regulations, maybe because of whatever. Yet the stuff overseas is a lot cheaper. Who the hell is inspecting that place? I mean, I would like to see the regulations be at a minimum here. Obviously, you have to have a clean place and everything. But the idea to have high regulations here, but anything you want in from overseas with the same vitamin C on it, that to me is the height of stupidity. Or is it just, am I just getting grumpy?
No, I would agree. I don't understand how Canada can, whether Canadians subsidize their drug industry or not, I don't know why their drugs are so much cheaper than our drugs.
That is very much because of price controls in Canada. Nevertheless, you can fill prescriptions in Canada, and everybody just kind of looks the other way, even though it is technically illegal.
But I'm sure you guys, since we know people that are on a lot of drugs, not the kind of drugs people used to be on, but the new kind of drugs with pills, must know somebody. Must know somebody who went from a very high priced drug here to a generic. And it found out that the generic, allegedly the same thing coming from China or India, doesn't do the same job. So it's obviously not manufactured the same way. The quality control is not the same way. I hear that all the time from listeners and stuff.
So you have to be very wary of any sourcing that you get overseas.
Oh, yeah. And I wonder...
It's clearly a buyer beware situation.
But why do you... I'll use the term screw a place here with regulations over the top, and then let somebody compete against them with none. I mean, to me, that makes kind of no sense.
Well, maybe we shouldn't. I don't know whether obviously. I guess we have too many regulations, and maybe some of that needs to be cut. I don't know. That's always a political point that Republicans make against Democrats, so maybe we need less regulation. Who knows?
Well, I mean, I guess...
We need the right regulation.
Yeah.
So, when you pile on a major compliance burden, what you're really doing is you're knocking the little guys out of business, because the compliance burden is roughly equal no matter what size you are. So the ones that can absorb the cost are the big guys. So the big companies will complain about regulation, but in reality, they like it because it keeps the ankle biters away from them.
Yeah, and it keeps innovation out too, I guess.
And it does. You're right, Mike. That's the innovation comes from the smaller companies, from the smaller and more nimble ones. So it's I'm not ruling out an answer to Tom's question about the why. I would not rule out abject stupidity.
Well, I mean, we've gone through, we started with somewhat of a theme today. I don't know if we ever really have a theme, but, what should, just looking around, people we know, what should the campaign be about? And Mike's right. The border stuff is a clear issue. And I also go back to the fact that the world being in total chaos, which is causing people that can't wait to leave where the hell they live, well, that's a problem too. I don't know if we can solve that in this election. But it's kind of the powder keg behind all this, I think. Not to mention the fact that the Mexican government can't seem to get their act together, no matter who's president. But we've just gone through, I mean, if you asked, if you guys were here, we went downstairs at a bar or over to Ceres or someplace and asked a bunch of people, okay, what's affecting you? It's going to be inflation, right? If anybody's on any kind of drugs, it's going to be on that. One of Audrey's friends caught COVID on a cruise. The new Pfizer 5-day COVID drug or 7 days, $1,200. What the bleep?
Come on, Paxlovid was $1,200.
Well, she with her insurance, it was $100 and a quarter. Without insurance, it's $1,200.
Wow.
All right, so that's an issue. Obviously, people's not getting anywhere near the raises as the inflation over the last 5-6 years. So we just rattle off, companies here being able to grow. Why aren't there 5 new factories in Chicago doing all the stuff? We need all this stuff. What is causing somebody to not being able to open up a place, get the financing, get the equity financing, get the loan financing? What are the barriers along the way here? Will nobody lend to these people or whatever? And Kevin's right. Michigan, at that level, there's several smaller banks that are willing to do it. Big banks, I don't think, give a crap, do they, Kevin? And these were these smaller businesses. So how can we address just the 4 things we came up with in the show today that none of them are going to be talked about anywhere along the line, are they?
Well,
go, Mike.
No, you're right, Tom. And, Gene and I were watching a talk show this morning, and actually somebody in Wisconsin, I think it was MSNBC, was polling voters as to what the issue should be. And the man, he was an older man, probably our age, and he said, well, they need to stop the mudslinging and talk about, real issues. And that's the thing. We will not Trump will do a lot of mudslinging, unfortunately, and he needs to talk about policy differences. And we'll see the Harris is already coming up with, oh, I'm the prosecutor, so it's a cop versus a con. So it's going to come down to personalities again, and that's wrong, but your substantive issues is a very valid point, Tom. They never talk about substantive issues.
Well, just as a pet peeve, I will say that in the last 7 years in my industry, the Trump presidency was a serious relief because the Department of Labor has now decided, I don't know how many people work there, that they're in charge, they're taking over from the SEC. Because they think that they control, because they make the laws for IRAs, they think they can control brokerages and other people that handle people's IRAs. And I don't think they have any idea what they're doing. Somebody changed an IRA to our firm lately, which I think is a good idea on their part. Got a bunch of stock, they wanted some protection with the market up here. We'll work through it. We'll get a plan for them like we do everybody. My brother has to fill out a form with our compliance people how we think we're going to do a better job with the IRA than the place that already was.
Oh, that's kind of crap.
Yeah? What does that mean? So somebody was at another place and say they were just long the market, okay? And the last few years have been really good being long the market. So all of a sudden the person maybe changes, they're now older, they retire, and they say, well, I can't just be long because this is my nest egg. I need to pay for some, quote, insurance. So if it goes down, I don't lose everything. Okay, so we do that for them. In the next 10 years, it keeps going up. Now, if we wouldn't have bought the insurance or the protection, obviously we would have done better than if we did. So does that mean we did a horrible job compared to what the other person who might just have left the thing in the market without any protection? It has nothing to do. Do you think the person at the Department of Labor is going to notice that nuance or not? I'm going to say no.
Do you think they're going to attempt to prosecute you in any way?
Yeah.
Under that circumstance.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, what do these people do all day? They're people that probably are able-bodied. They need to be doing something other than this, thinking up other stuff for people to do. In one man's opinion, I know it's being a little harsh, but just saying.
I don't think it's a little harsh. I think it's right on. Now, another thing you mentioned, too, is about bringing back manufacturing. You know what it's going to take is it's going to take another disaster. So a lot of people, a lot of companies learned a lesson from all the last round of supply chain disruptions. And so they are sourcing more product at home. There are more companies saying we better make our own. And so that's a good step, but it usually takes a catastrophic situation. What do I mean by that? Right now, if you want to go source something, whether it's China, whether it's whether it's Vietnam, it doesn't matter. You're going for the cheaper labor, and when you factor in labor plus shipping costs plus all of that kind of stuff, and if you can manage your suppliers and get things through on time, that works out pretty well for a company from a financial model standpoint. The problem is when you can't get parts, and now not only are you shutting down because you can't get your parts, but you're also losing market share, and that has long-term implications. Well, the lesson to learn is that you can bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. You can bring it back within the boundaries of the U.S. MCA and say, okay, I'm going to source in Mexico where the labor is cheaper, but it's not as cheap as the Far East. So you can do that, and that's a quantum improvement, a little less disruption. And you can also start investing in the automation that's available, and you're starting to see that get pushed like in fast food and places like that because the cost structure is so high. And you'll see it show up elsewhere because people are going to start saying, hey, you know what? I'm not going to get an 18-month payback for the investment, but I'm not going to get knocked out of the game again. So as long as it's paying back, if it takes 4 years or it takes 5 years, as long as it's a net positive to my bottom line, I'm going to continue to do that. The thing is, it's going to have to be learned as a really harsh lesson. Nobody ever makes a radical change like that until they just get kicked in the nuts.
Kevin, if you had to estimate, when we all know the labor's cheaper, and we don't seem to care about child labor if it's not here, how much...
Actually, a lot of companies do, and I can tell you a story about that.
Yeah, some do.
Go ahead with the question.
But I'm saying, how much of it, I think it's predominantly labor, but how much of it is... we don't seem to care if the Chinese pollute the world, and neither do they, and we care if we pollute here. I mean, how much of it is pollution laws? I mean, even people talk about these rare earth things, and I think you know more about this than me, but these rare earth stuff, we do have a lot of rare earth stuff here, but don't we ship it to China to get processed because the processing is so dirty?
Oh, China or Congo or, parts of Africa and so on. Yeah, it is definitely a pollution play, and it isn't that we can't take it out of the ground here. Although in some cases we can't, we're not allowed to, but it is more that the cost of taking it out of the ground in the U.S. is too high. It's always a cost play. I think people do lose, they lose their ethical core as companies. They lose that in the process of doing the income evaluation, the income effect. So I do think they lose it. And there are companies that are very strong on it. You can, and they're not all small companies. I know one company here that is in the process of extricating themselves from China, for two reasons. That one is they definitely will acknowledge that the geopolitics can kill their sourcing. But they are also, they're simultaneously, they're saying, I have to get out because we can't abide by the labor practices there.
Well, Kevin, what the, were you?
So that's part of it. But then you have stronger, large corporations. Motorola is really strong in this area.
When you talk about the person trying to extricate themselves from China, do you remember, it was a long time ago, Mattie Weber got the guest. The guy from the, was he from Wheaton or what?
Yeah, the guy who was the president of the American Uyghur Association. I actually used
that. No, not him. The guy whose company made Don't call it Teflon.
He made, pots and pans.
Well, he made the coatings. Don't call it Teflon. Very insulted. Yeah, very insulted if you said Teflon. But he moved. Oh yeah, if you said was that Teflon, they like shudder. Like, what are you, some kind of Luddite? Anyway, but he was over in China because that's where the pots and pans are being made. So there's no way that they were going to ship the pots and pans back to him in Wheaton or wherever he was to put the coatings on. So he had a. Now, how much the person you say that's extricating themselves out of there, are they there because they supply other people there, or they're the final good that if they leave, the other guys can come back too?
They
or
get parts. They get parts for local manufacturing here.
Okay. Okay. Well,
that's that's their sourcing, and so they're systematically. This is a one at a time. It's a couple of years of process to get that out without killing the business while they're at it, and to get themselves extricated from China. And that hasn't even begun for them. After it's only then that they're going to feel that they can start managing, making their suppliers do the same thing.
Well, when you go over there, from what I understand, and this is from one or two conversations. When I was in the Economic Club of Chicago back in the day, you get your, what's the term, Mike? You get your guy in the Chinese government that helps you put all this together when you first go over there. Well, now if you want
your liaison guy.
Yeah, your guy. The guy, he just gets to wet his beak a little bit, right? Now, on the way out, how difficult does that guy make it for you? Does anybody ever comment, Kevin, the guy you're talking about? Or do they make it?
But these guys haven't set up shop in China. They purchase from Chinese manufacturers.
I'm just wondering if they in their mind helped you out with all this to get the thing going, and you say, "See ya, I don't want to be here anymore." I wonder how easy that is. I bet you're leaving a whole bunch of stuff there.
Oh, I would imagine, yeah.
Yeah. Well,
but
so
nevertheless, I think the ethics side of the equation really needs to be considered and it needs to be discussed, but I don't think it's going to change until consumers are, until and unless, which I'm not optimistic is going to happen, but until consumers are educated in what these issues are and they start to care, they start to purchase according to what matters. And I'm not so optimistic that because I think we don't educate people.
I think part of it's education, and maybe Mike can be the referee on this one. But through the days, since I'm a little taller than the average bloke, not as tall anymore as I used to be, probably. But I've always had to buy stuff through catalogs, right? Because they were the only ones that had talls and everything. And as catalogs come and go, and the companies come and go. From time to time, there's been companies that will say, these blue jeans are made in America. And the other blue jeans are $60 and they're 75 or 80. Or something is made here or it's got the better cotton and something, something. Then there's like the old Navy stores that, you buy something there and it, three washings and, well, I haven't been in a long time, three washings and it was shot. So you always get that difference. And you still can, if you want to, go online and find some place that makes your... Your khakis are are made here, and they're probably 25-30% more. And it seems like Duluth Trading, those jeans are gone. LL Bean, those jeans are gone. And it's like that nobody buys them. And I wonder if you have a family today, as much as you may can't stand Zhao Xing or whatever the guy's in charge over there. Fact is, if you got five kids, you're shopping at Old Navy, buying stuff from China. I mean, I wonder how much of it is, what flexibility you really have with a family if you're hurting for cash.
Well, you don't, which is another aspect of the economic hurt that we have.
Yeah, I mean, I think on a very important question, Kevin, I'm sure you weren't involved in this, Mike. Did you try and watch the Cubs? It didn't start till 8:30. How many innings did you last? And did you realize they didn't score any runs?
Yes, I did realize I lasted to the eighth inning.
Wow, good for you! I was about a fourth.
And then I knew from doing what I do every morning when I wake up, I put on Quick Pitch to get the final outcome and any highlights.
There couldn't have been any highlights, although somebody pitched pretty well.
Oh, there were a few defensive gems. And, yeah, Tyone was very good.
How can you have, like, the best pitching, like, in baseball and you still can't win?
Because they can't hit.
Well, you know,
hey, just a couple of real quick, because we, you know, I know you wanted to talk about draft and all that, and we definitely don't have time.
Let's push that to Friday.
Two big baseball complaints. Okay, the first one is every time the visiting team's pitcher throws to first, the crowd boos. Now, this is stupid because when crowds originally started to boo about throws over to first base, it was like when a pitcher threw over five or six times and was really just dragging it out. And the crowd would boo to say, get on with it. And somewhere along the way, they decided that, you know, baseball fans would just boo every time someone throws to first base. It's particularly stupid now because it's really a good thing if the pitcher throws over to first base and doesn't get the runner, because he only has two disengagements, so if he can get him to throw over the second time, the runner has a huge advantage, because if he's not picked off on the third throw, it's a balk, he gets the base. So it's just a really stupid thing. So that's number one. Number two is I really, really wish that all these guest singers that they get for the seventh inning stretch at Wrigley Field, I really wish one of them somewhere, sometime, would get the words to the song right.
Oh, come on. You're asking way too much.
Well, it's on the video board. So it's not Cracker Jacks. It's Cracker Jack. It is, I don't care if, it's I don't care if I never get back, not ever. And it is, let me root for the home team, not for its root. I mean, people, you know, it's like... It's like all the misstated rock and roll lyrics. These people are just stupid.
Maybe they had the same problem the lady did singing the national anthem. They're all drunk.
Well, that could be it, but... The ultimate drunk one was Ditka.
Oh yeah, got it. Well, you know, you mentioned that my years as a Cub fan, I always had my seats, and you know, as a big guy, I don't like people standing up in front of me because I can't see. But I would never stand up, knowing that nobody behind me could see at all, me being 6'4", right? So I had my seats first row upper deck. And I'm happy as a clam up there, right? What's it? Happy as a clam in high water, Mike? Is that what?
So I have no idea, Tom. You got me on that one.
Yeah, and Kevin's can of corn.
So one day I get offered some seats from somebody, and I go sit with the rabble, right? Not that I'm a, you know, high end guy or anything, but I wanted my seats with nobody in front of me. So all of a sudden I'm sitting there, and remember when they had the guy Wendell? What was his last name? Kevin, the third base coach. Wendell.
Oh, Wendell Kim.
Yeah, Wendell Kim. So he waved a few people home, and they were out. So all of a sudden, the entire rage, even before there was like Twitter and stuff, was the guy's an idiot, right? So then I'm out of the game.
He actually got more than the usual number thrown out.
Oh yeah. So he was aggressive, Kevin.
He was aggressive.
He was like your brother Tim catching third, coaching third. Everybody just go. Anyway, that's why we never let him do that anymore. But all of a sudden he stops this guy, so the entire stands starts going, Wendell sucks. Wendell sucks. The guy next to me is singing as loud as he can. When he stops yelling, I go, buddy, the guy had been out by 30 feet. Oh yeah, I know that, but everybody else is yelling, so I got to. I'm thinking. I'm like, at least he admitted it. I looked at him, I go, okay then. He's like, okay then. Anyway, guys, thank you. Can we send a list of, can we run the debate for these two people and not let them do any insulting, just talk about the subjects? Think we could ever do that?
Well, I really do like the format with the mic turned off when you're not speaking.
I want to just have a full cone come down and cover the person who's not speaking.
So you can't see the facial expression.
Can't see
too,
anything, right? And then just pull it back up. Okay, now you can talk.
We could also go with a basher arm or something like that that comes down and nails them.
A zapper of some kind.
Bzz. Yeah. Oh, electric shock. I like it.
Well, like you do for the dogs if they go too far away from the fence line?
Yeah, shock collars. Yep.
God. You know what? It probably wouldn't be such a bad idea. SBP, talk to you dudes on Friday. Friday, let's cover the baseball stuff, Kevin, because we're trying to cover, Mike, is that there's a huge dynamic shift, probably gradual, that I, of course, just missed. The 20 people the Cubs drafted, 17 of them in baseball were from college. And I have to guess, if you go back 10, 15 years, that would have been the other way, wouldn't you think?
Well, it's a 20-year progression. They call it the Moneyball draft philosophy. And I sent you an article about how that has aged.
All right, well, we're going to talk about...
probably a better investment, Tom, to get them out of college. They're proven players to a degree.
Yeah,
I mean, we can take a dive into the whys, you know, when we have time. I know we're cutting into Russell's time pretty good here, so...
All right.
So let's pick it up on Friday.
We'll do that. Thanks, guys. Well, why don't we drag Russell in right away? SP Futures down 44 now, NASDAQ Futures down 240. Russell, you with us?
I'm here.
What'd you think of
Westman?
Yeah, what'd you think we were talking about? Bud, how are you?
Doing okay.
So we covered
with an audience of dogs just looking at me right now, like, who the hell are you talking to?
Who are you? You got the beagle and the Frenchie, or are you babysitting?
I got two Frenchies and a beagle right now.
Where's the other Frenchie from?
We have a Frenchie that we are temporarily hanging on to until she gets fixed and everything. And then she's going to be adopted out, and she is going to make some family a hell of a dog.
I'm going to say she's going to be...
We're having a hard time, and there's a lot of back and forth in the Rhodes household, but we're not... Part of doing the foster thing is we're not supposed to adopt them. So,
honey, I could never give baby, one up.
Well, we did adopt one. So the one that was only supposed to live 6 months, that's pushing 3 years in the Rhodes household, that one... We adopted full time.
Audrey's crazy little dog Maggie, the little Maltese. Who the minute I walk in, she loves it because she immediately starts barking at me to go for a walk. She sleeps right next to me. She's like, and then when I leave on Sunday, the look on her face is like, you know, what are you doing to me? Well, she.
Oh yeah.
She's selling this condo, right? So the guy is terrific. The lady is. Got some issues. and they got this dog, this little Maltese, that they kept her like in a cage.
Oh.
And so lady goes, well, we're going to get rid of the dog, blah, 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 because the new place won't take dogs. And Audrey says, well, why don't you give me the dog? I'll make sure she goes to the right shelter, the no-kill shelter, and I'll make sure she gets...
Yeah.
So she brings the little goofball home. And she is she's such a little shit. I mean, she doesn't pay attention to anybody except herself. But I love her. I mean, so her dad, who's 95 at the time, she hops up in his lap, looks at him, and he goes, she's not going anywhere. and you know what? Made herself at home, and he lasted another 3-4 years, and she was like peanut butter and jelly with him and her. Yeah. And you know what? It was a great thing. And he goes, no, she's not going anywhere. Audrey goes, okay. I guess we got a new dog. I mean, I could never foster. I'd never come back.
Yeah, that's why it's tough. But we know that the third dog right now is not going to be with us in about a month or so. Although my wife and daughter are trying real hard to get somebody in the neighborhood to adopt her.
Oh, like the next door neighbor, you can still go see her?
Yeah.
still now, is that really giving her up?
It sort of, I guess, but not, you know.
God.
It'll probably end up over here all the time anyway.
Oh, God. Well, that's fine. I mean, you love yeah. Did you see the commercial with about the 7 or 8 Frenchie puppies? God, are they adorable, the little white ones?
Oh, they're the best. They are just the funniest freaking things in the world.
My mom used to have
they're like hyper, they're crazy freaking dogs, and then I think they hit a certain age and they just walk around, they look irritated all the time.
Well, my mom, she grew up with, you know, you don't see these anymore, but they're great little dogs too. The little Boston Terriers, the little black and white ones.
Yeah, yeah. So
those are great little dogs too, and they're not afraid of anything. They're absolutely not afraid
no.
of anything.
No.
But they think they're 10 feet tall. Anyway, the other guys, we were talking about some of the issues, and your name has been bannered about all week, and we actually talked about it with Professor Hale yesterday, your professor buddy. And, you know, what causes, and how long it's gone way further than I ever could have dreamed. How long can China, how long can Japan, how long... I mean, Japan is up to, what, well over two times their GDP on their debt.
On their debt,
How long before there's a problem? I mean, it seems like we're going forever here, it seems.
It's like a race to the bottom, doesn't it feel like it? Who's going to blow up first?
But I mean, Japan has proven that you can have zombie banks. Now, when I say that for the listeners, it means, okay, what if, and don't take this out of context, what if Citigroup all of a sudden had, you know, five or six massive loans to China that, you know, maybe the Fed knows about, nobody else knows about, all just go under, and all of a sudden Citigroup has negative capital. Okay, mm-hmm. Well, it probably wasn't a cash event, right? They're just not getting paid. I mean, but so Citigroup, in terms of you walking in, depositing your paycheck, you know, getting a checking account, writing checks, which nobody does anymore, you know, Zelle money out of there, and really on a day-to-day basis, nothing really changes, right? If you're big enough. Now, if you're small enough,
then they
take you to the woodshed and sell your stuff to another bank. But if you're big enough, you pretty much can land there forever, right? Until you build this capital base back up, correct?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. But if you're small, then they take you out, which is another kind of weird thing with the system. Because, I mean, the Silicon Valley Bank, if they'd have been Wells Fargo, they'd still be in business, right?
Yeah. Almost. It would have been bailed out instead of... they got absorbed into somebody else.
Yeah.
I remember right.
And,
they would have, Wells Fargo, exactly. Because of their, you know, systemic importance. Like, you know, there are 10 or 15 banks that regardless of what they do, we can't ever let them go out of business.
Right. But now
And that's exactly the industry you want to be working in.
Well, yeah. Well,
you know that you're never going to go out of business.
Well, look at the people that are able to look at the industries that, if you and I were to name them, would say, okay, which are the industries that maybe, because of government largesse, make too much money? I'm going to say the drug industry, insurance industry, clearly the government itself, maybe the exchanges, because they seem to have morphed into not really creating
the greatest... For-profit entities.
Yeah, for-profit entity where they charge you for, like, quotes. Look at the amount of people that are working from home. Look, nobody's in the Fed building, right?
No.
I mean, how many people work for the exchanges that aren't at home? I mean, how many people work...
I was over there. I was at the post office on Monday and at SIBO and didn't see a whole, you know... I think a lot of people do work from home on Mondays.
Yeah, and I mean, it's... There are firms that probably doesn't matter where you do it, and you know, it's up to them. But it seems like there's amazing concentration in the ones where they seem to have a lot of money without they don't have to do anything to get it. Is that, for lack of a better term? There's got to be people that invested in China that aren't getting their interest checks. How is it we never hear about anything like that? I mean,
We did. We heard with Evergrande, you know, that they had defaulted on their dollar bonds.
Well, there never was a list of the biggest holders in this country. I never saw it. Probably somewhere, maybe, but I didn't see it.
I saw it. I was able to pull it up on my Bloomberg because there were some municipal funds that were in there.
Okay.
But, yeah, you know, nobody, I don't know, nobody. I'll repeat exactly what I said last week, is that anybody that invests in China, if you lose your money, shame on you for investing in China.
Why?
They don't play by the same rules. They, you know, if you, you know, what Trump got criticized years ago because he must have ties in China because he opened up a bank account in China. Well, that's because he was doing business over there, and they make you open up a bank account over there so they can, you know, so they can control the money and make it very difficult, if not impossible, for you to get the money out of there.
Now, when you say in China, was it a mainland China or Hong Kong?
Yeah, mainland China.
Really? I didn't even know you could do that.
What do you mean, do what?
I didn't even know you could open up a bank account in the mainland China.
No, you have to. You have to.
Oh, I mean, if you got a business. All right.
Yeah, if you got a business. You can't do business over there if you don't use one of their local banks. And they have, you know, they'll put all kinds of restrictions on trying to get money out of that country. Every rich person in China is tries every way, shape, and form to get money out of that country.
And some of them do.
Yeah, they do. That's why there are a whole ton of really nice houses in Vancouver that nobody's ever lived in.
Well, there's a little
people from China buying them, and then at some point they can sell them, and they can get, you know, they could get their Canadian dollars for
it. Can there be a more beautiful city than Vancouver?
No, there can't be.
I was there once, it's awe-inspiring. Yeah. Just driving down the street, yeah. It's awe-inspiring.
You walk down one of the grid streets in Chicago, and maybe you look out toward the lake, but you don't see anything. Same thing there, you see these massive mountains that just make you feel really small.
Well, plus, the weather, in the wintertime, I think it's warm enough where your boat, assuming you have one, you don't have to take it out of the water, right? And yet you can go 10 miles and go skiing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
a cool part of the world.
But
super cool part of the world. You guys were talking about the supply chain stuff.
Yeah.
And what I've seen going on is, want to make the Chinese government, you don't want to make the Communist Party mad. And so you don't make this big announcement, we're moving all of our manufacturing operations to India or Vietnam or Mexico, but you see it happening.
The companies are
doing it, but they're doing it quietly because they don't want to, you know, they don't want to, they want to get out of there as smoothly as possible.
Well, the person who was on the show with us and the person that I talked to at that Economic Club of Chicago function a long time ago, they all are there because the people that they supply are there. So when they moved, now, what happens then if the people, like the one guy, he's a perfect example, he did the coatings for pots and pans. And the pots and pans guys all moved to China. So he says, no way that they were shipping the pots and pans back to Wheaton for us to coat. We had to find a place to do it over there. So they went in the same area, and who knows who ships what to what. I don't know if the coating goes to the manufacturer and he puts it on, or the pot goes to this guy and he puts it on. I never asked him that, or if I did, I forgot. You know, so he's not going anywhere until they go somewhere, right? I mean, there's kind of a choreography over there, not just... I mean, there's a supply chain there, too, correct? There's got to be.
Yeah. So, I mean, for cheap stuff like that, I when I talk about switching your supply chain around, I'm higher-end stuff, like
right.
iPhones, for one. You know, they're starting to make more and more... they're starting to make some iPhones in India. But, you know, I think everybody is diversifying their supply chains after what happened around COVID.
If you had to lob a guess out there, I know I'm taking you off track here, which I always do. Things flash into my feeble brain. When people argue about auto manufacturers and how these guys that, you know, put the cars together, you know, they make too much money, blah blah blah. Aren't we down to like 30 some hours a car or something? Now, when you put together a cell phone, how many manual hours are actually in the damn thing? I mean, or it's got to be.
I bet it
can't be very many, Russell.
No, I feel like the labor cost of an iPhone is under $50.
I'm going to say, it can't be 10 hours, is it?
No.
I mean, the whole thing, I would think there'd be some massive assembly line where we're stamping these little. You're asking me what's in a cell phone. It's got to be
a lot of electronics.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. I'm not sure how that even would why you couldn't be competitive here. I mean, what's the difference if you're paying $20 an hour versus 10 if there's 2 hours in the thing and it costs $1,500?
Well, that's why I think the big beneficiary of a lot of this is going to be northern Mexico, because that's where. The labor difference between the U.S. and China, I think it does make it prohibitive to do these things in the U.S. Plus, I don't, you know, there's just not a lot of people that want to go into that want to take a manufacturing job.
Well, that's for sure the truth.
Yeah, I mean that's part of the issue. I mean, I told you my macro plan. What I blurted this one out there a few times, and it's In concept, it sounds kind of cool. I don't know if it would actually work, but start to bring as much manufacturing back to the United States as you can, and put the hiring offices in northern Mexico. And then, you know, and that's how you get people to immigrate to the U.S. You have someone that has been hired by a company, that's going to come here and work in manufacturing, has a job set up already, and is thrilled to get it.
Well, I don't want to go into a huge immigrant discussion regarding how many should be here and all that other kind of stuff, because I honestly don't know. I mean, I see massive problems worldwide to where everybody doesn't want to live where they live. That part,
yeah,
I surely get.
Yeah, you can't blame them on that. You just can't.
But I don't understand why our inability here, and that's what really troubles me about both of our candidates. And it's not the policy. It's not the people who follow them. I don't see a talent in either one of the people in being able to sit down and say, okay, we need a battleship. You guys go design it. You guys start putting the manufacturing facility together. I don't see people that can go from point A to point B and like solve anything. I mean, say we. I'm not saying they should be here or shouldn't be here. I don't want to get in that discussion. Plus, I know you don't want to either. But it's but if we have 3,000 immigrants here, or 10, or whatever the number is, and we've got two absolutely closed, or damn near, they used to be technical schools with big hunks of property around them, why don't we get those things back to what they were doing? By the way, there's other people in the city that sure could help, could use some training as well.
Oh yeah.
Why don't we have? Why can't adults or students? Why isn't it open at night? I read this in it's a distant memory. There's only 200 or 300 people left in Tilden Tech. I don't know if there's anybody left at CVS. Okay, those places used to have a Tilden Tech. My cousin told me they used to have a garage where they had an aircraft engine. We learned how to work on aircraft engine. Why can't we? Not just for the immigrants, but there's a lot of people in the city that are, these jobs pay well now, by the way.
Yeah.
We have nothing but problems with housing here. Half the places aren't insulated. I mean, we have so much work to do. And if you were to say, you can, by the way, we'll farm you out as assistants during the day and you can come work at night, or you can, even if it's a butler tent building area around there, you can stay here. We'll get something for you in the day. Oh, by the way, at night you go to class and you learn how to do this stuff for where you become a, instead of just carrying the wire for you or me, in 6 months you're going to be an electrician. We don't have any capability of this, and it's not because of the immigrant problem. I don't want to get into whether the guy should be here or shouldn't be here. The fact is, you got a dude here that's hanging around in the Home Depot parking lot looking for a job. We got all kinds of jobs around here, and oh, by the way, we have these dormant buildings that used to train people to do this that they're not doing anything. I mean, somehow or another, Russell, you got to deal with what you have. Okay, maybe you shouldn't be here, but while you are, how about we teach you how to put plasterboard up and get you a job? I mean, don't we need more people paying taxes instead of,
Exactly. Instead of living off of the taxes.
What is wrong with us?
I think there are a lot of problems behind that. One is, like you said, there are only 200-300 people left at technical school. That's like nobody really wants to work.
Well, I mean, does nobody?
Yeah, I'm sorry, but
okay,
nobody
really wants. Well, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? There's nobody there, and yet my nephew's firm, when they go out to hire a new machinist or inspector, they can't find somebody unless they're from the Army or someplace.
You know what? This kind of goes along lines of something that I can't remember who I heard say this, but it used to be that your job was something that you were, your vocation was something that you were proud of. I do this. And at some point it went from this is what I do to this is how much money I make.
Well, yeah.
And yeah, it really totally morphed from, I've got kind of, I'm a college professor. It is one of the coolest jobs in the world.
Well, there is.
I'm sure not making a fortune at it, But you know, I think I'm not normal because I take more pride in what it is I'm doing than chasing a whole ton of money.
Well, but you guys, right, when I said there seems to be, and you know, I don't want to give either one of you guys a whole lot of kudos because, you know, it'll only just go to your head. But in Indiana, what you and Kevin are doing is dramatic work, and yet I don't see anything like that happening here in the city. I see nothing like that. I mean, how the hell are we going to put? You take the Orange Line or any place, take the Rock Island. You see all these buildings that used to be manufacturing buildings that are still there. I mean, if they're right on rails. They're perfect spots. How the hell are we?
There are tons of people around.
Yeah. How is it that we can't get one of these places? If the biggest thing, and you know more about this, you're a professor. You need money. You need parts. You need a distribution system. You need you know, travel to and from your place so people can get there. And, oh, by the way, you need something called human capital. We don't have any here. But in Indiana, not only is Kevin's group trying to do the kind of training that I'm talking about, if somebody wants to go further, they get them into IU South Bend. They get them into, and some of them even come down where you are. The idea that nobody wants these jobs, I got to believe there's an awful lot of people that if you got them a job as a machinist, which by the way is a lot of fun. I wish I knew how to do that. If I did that, making $35-$40 bucks an hour, why wouldn't I want to do that? I mean, what's the point? Maybe plus you make more than that now. An inspector, my nephew was going, I was like 50, which is not the top of the world, but it's overtime and stuff is 100 and something a year. It's not horrible.
Yeah, you can live off of that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the, but for the city not to understand that that's the reason why people are leaving here. It's a human capital. Now, you're always going to get people moving to Chicago because it's got an awful lot of nice stuff for these high tech firms. But that's not your. We need places that have 300-400 people. Why we don't make railroad cars here in Chicago when we buy so damn many of them between the city? That's crazy. Why isn't that here? I mean, I just...
It seems like it would be a lot easier here.
You would think? With, like, the train lines going right to your door type of thing? I mean...
It may start all the way up at the top where, as a country... what president was it that said the business of America is business or something like that?
It probably was like Hoover or somebody back there.
Yeah, you know, we've gotten away from that. I don't know what we stand for as a country anymore or what a typical person in the U.S. is, but it seems like we're more concerned about minor social issues that get blown out of proportion, calling somebody by the wrong pronoun and crap like that. That those types of things for some reason have become what we seem to care the most about.
Well, you know, and, what? I've told you this before. Audrey's dad worked for Ryerson Steel, right? No, he was in the war. He was a guy who did repaired and built runways. So all through the Pacific Theater, you know, I think he was in Okinawa or someplace where they would bivouac next to the, I think he worked on the Trans-Canada Highway before the war. Anyway, but one day we're driving up north. I don't know where the hell we were going. And we're driving on Lakeshore Drive, and he points to the Hancock Center, and he goes, Tom, you see that place? I go, yeah. And he goes, well, that's the Hancock Center. I know that. I didn't want to say that. He goes, yeah. Let me tell you something. That place is never coming down. And I go, okay. See all those steel beams? He said, I drilled a lot of those holes. They're drilled in just the right spot, just the right size. Everyone's inspected. That place was put up right because I drilled half those holes. I'm like, okay.
That's so funny because I was, back when I used to volunteer at some inner city schools in Atlanta, we were on a field trip once, and this one kid, as we were going, he pointed at different high rises as we went along. Said, my dad helped build that. My dad helped build that. My dad. That's the pride part that I don't think anybody has anymore.
Well, when you
I don't think the average American has anymore. There, I mean, I see them. I see the exceptional students, but then I had this one student, or we made little promotional videos a while back for Kelly, and this one student, all he did was talk about how he was going to get paid once he had his Kelly degree. Not the kind of work he was going to do. Nothing. Just, I know I'm going to get paid.
Well, the I was only, you know, a finance dude at Pullman, but I was there from the Boston cars, which, you know, which the Amtrak cars are obviously beautiful. The Boston cars were nice too, but you know, you sit there and all of a sudden you're fighting in these meetings over ordering this piece of metal, you're ordering the trucks, you're making sure everything's done properly. And, you know, 4 months later, the first guy stamps the first piece of metal, and all of a sudden you start seeing some stuff together, and you see the tooling rigs coming together, and guys putting those together. And, I mean, it's fascinating stuff. You'll see a tooling rig, we'll go to break here in a minute, you might put, like for the undercarriage of the train, there might be 80 or 100 pieces of metal in it. Well, mm-hmm. You don't just stand there by hand and start screwing them together. You put a tooling rig together that's done perfectly, and everything's clamped down. And when you weld them together, all the clamps are done in such a way where they allow the shrinkage, because when you weld something together, it wants to pull. So everything has to be designed to allow that, just a little bit of shrinkage, so that all of a sudden the thing doesn't turn on its side and turn left, because it could happen if you don't allow for that. Well, see this thing coming together, then you see the seats get delivered, you see all of a sudden the side goes up, and then the roof goes on, and then all of a sudden one day, this gorgeous car that's clean and spotless rolls out the door, and you go, holy bleep, Batman, I was part of that? I mean, look at that thing, it's gorgeous. I mean, I can only imagine what the guys at Boeing think when one of those planes can walk out of there.
Oh, I know I've asked you before, and I can't remember. But the Boeing facility in Seattle is absolutely incredible.
I've never been. It's got to be, how many is it square miles under roof or something?
All I know is they move the planes forward like it's a kind of a reverse assembly line, and they've got three planes in there at a time.
Wow. SP Futures down 51.
It's just massive.
SP Futures down 289. We come back. How about commenting a little on the Tesla and the Google and the Meta here? Because I don't know about this Tesla. I never trusted the place seemed like the first 10 years all I did was make money because everybody else had to send them a check. I still don't know how much money the place is ever going to make. They're never going to pay anybody a dividend. Don't take that as a sell. Maybe it's a buyer this morning down $22, but we'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI ProDirect can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI ProDirect. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com, PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
There's something happening here. What it is.
Hello, North Bank Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Andrew on the board. SP Futures down 53. As if we're just on 305, I thought we'd see some bite of dippers here, and they're not here yet. Maybe they're still having breakfast or having a Bloody Mary somewhere. Dow futures down 182. Again, these stocks that are down heavy, meaning the Tesla and the Microsoft and the Meta, none of those are in the Dow. The only one of the crazy seven that is the Apple, and they're only down a buck and a half. Microsoft is one of them. They're down five, so sorry, oops, on that one. Microsoft's down five, that's 1.5%. Over in Europe, they were down earlier, but not real heavy. DAX down 135, that's 0.7%. FTSE down 1, call that flat. CAC RON down 74, that's 1%. So a couple down and FTSE not so much. We're in Asia, Nikkei down 439, that's 1.1%. Hang Seng down 158, 0.9%. Shanghai down 13, 0.4, barely hanging over 2,900, 2,901. So they stopped just in time there. Bonds unchanged, 4.24. The Bund unchanged 4.2.44.
Japan up 2 basis points, 1.09, which has got to be pretty close to their high. Might be. We'll ask Russell on that. He knows all this stuff. Oil up 87 cents, 77.83, but still down from the 82.83 from like 10 days ago. So we've had a, you know, kind of a drop in oil here. Brent, except not today. Brent up 72 cents, 81.79. Natural gas down 6 cents, 2.12. Danger of going under $2 here again. RBOB up 3 cents, 2.44. Gold trying to creep back up here again, up 10.20, 24.17. It got up over 24.50 and it got blasted back down, actually under 2,400. Now it's creeping again. Silver up 11 cents, 29.44. Same thing there. It was over 30, whack, 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 and now it's creeping again. Copper down 1 cent, 4.14. We have the U.S. dollar unchanged today, 108.4 against the euro. So the euro is down a little bit from where it was, but it's also up some from where it was 3 weeks ago. Same thing with the British pound, 129. It got down under 128, then it got back to 130. Now it's settling back down again. Crypto, Bitcoin up 713, 66,441. A lot of stuff there, Andrew. What do you got for us? Trevi Weather Sports, Cubs can't hit.
No, they cannot. It is 7:39 here in Chicago on Wednesday, July 24th. And yeah, jumping right into sports, the Sox lost to the Rangers 2-3. The Cubs lost to the Brewers 1-0. And the Diamondbacks won over the Royals 6-2. Over to Chicago weather, it is currently 70 degrees right now. We're going to have a little bit of scattered morning showers, not too much. Otherwise, it'll be a little bit cooler today with some clouds rolling in. We're going to have a high of 73. Over in Phoenix, they're going to have a hot and partly cloudy sky today. They're currently at 94. They're going to have a high of 114. They also have a blowing dust advisory, so the air quality is not going to be great today. Finally, for Chicago traffic, on the inbound expressways, we have some heavy traffic kind of building up. If you're near, middle of the Eisenhower near Austin Boulevard, if you're on the outbound, expect delays near about the same on Austin Boulevard, on the Eisenhower, and about all throughout the Kennedy. But to update on the major accident from earlier, the ramp to 290 East has closed. This is on the eastbound Eisenhower near the I-294 South. There was a semi that has rolled over and has now closed the right two lanes, I believe, and that is causing delays of up to 20 minutes around there. So that is all I got.
Any truth to the rumor that Russell's got the two Frenchies over there running out there grabbing cans of vegetables and bringing them back to his car?
That's exactly what I've trained them to do.
God. Yeah. Hey, did you realize that a new record was set yesterday, or set on Monday? A new daily surface temperature high since these guys this sounds like something you'd be part of. The EU's Copernicus Climate Change Service. Copernicus, what did he invented what? What was his, what did he discover again? My brain's going nuts. Yeah, he did something. Was he, Isaac
something
Newton?
Something in space.
Yeah, he wasn't, Isaac Newton was gravity, right? When the apple fell on his head. Anyway, Now you got me curious. Andrew, why don't you Google Copernicus, see what the hell he did. He did something of note. Hey, Russell, every day I talk about this and mention your name. Why, seemingly, not necessarily an everyday basis, why is there such a seemingly often difference between Hong Kong going one way and mainland China going another? I don't recall that happening very often before.
You would see that happen periodically, and there are different types of companies listed on Hong Kong Exchange versus what you have in mainland China. And most of the mainland China listings are heavily controlled by the Communist Party already.
Okay.
Like they're big shareholders in all of those. You would see disconnects between. In fact, we would bring those groups from China over periodically, and they would be from Shanghai, and somebody would start talking about the Hong Kong exchange or Hong Kong stocks. I'm like, that's not us. We're completely different. There are different capital controls for investing in the stocks that are in mainland China versus the Hong Kong exchange. The Hong Kong exchange is a lot more open. I would almost equate, I started to say kind of like Japan versus China, but that's probably a bit extreme. That's why you see that disconnect periodically, and it does happen.
Well, Russell, for a long, long, long time,
you and I could not invest directly in the Chinese market, correct? We could invest in Hong Kong. And then I'm going to say, well, before COVID, BC, before Christ, before COVID, wasn't some, I use the term, deal made where four or five big companies here, and I forget who they were able to actually put together mutual funds with some of the stuff on the mainland China, and you could invest in those mutual funds?
Yeah, they developed a method where people outside China could directly buy stocks, but there's like a daily, there was a daily quota on how much volume could come from outside. And I think there was a, I think part of that was to make sure they don't have any really nasty downside volatility. And I forgot what the term was for that, but it was almost like the Hong Kong Exchange was able to get some sort of direct, direct line to, everybody's freaking out over here. Direct line to the Shenzhen Exchange or something like that, but that direct line, it's like it was limited as to how much it could be used each day.
Wasn't there a Vanguard and a few people like that and Goldman? Weren't there like seven or eight firms that actually could participate in a China mutual fund or something?
Yeah, and that's the way that they were able to go about doing that.
It still couldn't be that you and I could go buy a single stock, I don't think.
I think you really jump to a whole ton of hoops and be a really big institution to do that.
Well, plus you have to change
but
your.
But here's the other thing: is I don't really know because I would never want to do that.
Right now, but if we wanted to, even though you've been our guy that says Hong Kong keeps getting more and more Chinese every time you go over there, when I say Chinese mainland China, we could have bought, changed the dollar for a Hong Kong dollar, and bought a share of stock on the Hong Kong Exchange, right?
Oh, yeah. You could trade on the Hong Kong Exchange, no problem.
Well, you do have to make the currency switch.
You still can, and you still can.
Is the Hong Kong still use their dollar, or are they tied into the Chinese currency now?
I think they still have a Hong Kong dollar, but I won't be shocked when they... And the Chinese yuan is so tightly controlled and everything. Nobody... I really... on the Communist Party's part to try to do away with the Hong Kong dollar. It's a currency that they have, that they can still use, and has a little bit more credibility than the Chinese yuan.
Well, I know you're not a drinking man, but I would have loved to have had you at the series Friday night with the group I was with. First of all, it was one of the big quant guys from OCC talking about some big meeting they had with these other quant guys. And I can only imagine that I'm sure they had more quants than I ever dreamed of. They were talking about risk in the market and counterparty risk and blah, blah, blah. First of all, I didn't know what the definition of counterparty risk was. I mean, there really isn't any counterparty risk in exchange-traded funds, right? Exchange-traded options. But I guess they were in their mind, counterparty risk is firms not being able to come up with the money for other firms. I guess that's sort of their definition. So they were talking about that. And then I talked to a couple of guys who have been risk managers, these big firms. And I said, if all of a sudden this interest rates were to flip and this, the 10-year were to go to 6, 7, 8, which, with the short term, everything says I'm nuts. But Russell, if the short term stays at 5.5, the 10-year ought to be 6.5, right, or 7. Just saying. I mean, when I say auto, it's kind of the normal way. It should be higher than the short term, shouldn't it?
Well, it should be, unless you think the short ones are coming down.
Right,
and
right.
That's what everybody believes. So.
But I went through sitting here trying to mind my own business, have a glass of wine, and I ended up giving a whole lecture on short stock interest and short stock and borrowing. And nobody had any idea what I was talking about.
Really?
Huh. I said, what's your short stock interest rate? What do you mean? Mm-hmm. What do you mean? What do I mean?
Were they with the brokerage firm or were they with the OCC?
They're guys that were manage these big companies that, you know, liquidity providers, you know, the Citadel type people, although it wasn't from Citadel. But nobody gets the part. I said that if the interest rates get high enough, there's big money in short and stock.
Yeah, because you borrow the shares and you get cash and you can make some interest off that.
Yeah, you end up getting
that's how I try to get people to visualize. I actually was talking about this Monday night class.
Really?
And that's how
the kids,
mechanics behind shorting, but then also that there is some interest involved in it as well, and you know, and the way that I try to get everybody to visualize it, and I know I'm oversimplifying it, but just say, you know, you borrow stock, somebody gives you some cash for it, well, you can make some interest off that cash.
Well, were they all just head bobbers?
Yeah.
For those that don't know what that term means, when I was, you know, we used to do a lot of lecturing at PTI, but not as much as Russell going over the world, but we used to do a lot. And I did some for the exchange, and so my brother, you know how brothers are, the world's greatest guy, but I'm sitting there and I go, all right, does everybody understand that? And he goes, hey, they're head bobbing. Head bobbing means everybody's raising their head up and down, but if you asked any one of them a question, they'd have no idea what you just said, right?
They're wanting you to keep going.
Yeah, they're head bobbing. Well, yeah, because I said, hey, when the first thing you did when you went to a clearing firm, as a market maker, you'd say, what am I doing on my borrowing? And they would say, okay, you're two over broker call if you're a regular schlump. If you're a bigger guy, you might be one over broker call. And then they'd say, what's my short stock rate? And they'd say, well, 80% of broker call. The two guys I said that to said, they did what? I said, that's what you traded on. I mean, because, God, I shouldn't even do this, Russell, but if you short stock, you borrow it from somebody, okay, somebody pays for it, correct? Now, the money goes to where the stock came from, where the guy borrowed the stock, right? Because that firm gets the cash. But now you get credit because you're the one who shorted it. That guy might get 20 or 25% of the total nut. You might get 75, 80. I, there were people that were big enough getting 85 and 90. That was rare. But 80 was was a reasonable number. So if you shorted, you know, $10 million worth of stock, which isn't a whole hell of a lot, if you got options against it, there's no risk there. If you shorted that, you could have multi-million dollars in your account or credit. The money's not in your account. It's somewhere else. And you're making, you know, if you're 80% of broker call and broker call was 10, you're making 8% on millions of dollars. That's like real dough. Mm-hmm. And nobody had any idea what I was talking about. I mean, how long has that been? 35 years?
Yeah, it's been since I was,
Yeah, what I'm saying.
It's been since the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, does anybody get anything for short? Now, most of the time, if you have a, oh God, we're getting way too technical here. But if you see a stock that comes out like say Trump stock, out of the blue, I could kick it up here, but the options wouldn't be on there yet. First thing you see, you and I will notice, Russell, that it seems like the puts are a lot higher than the calls, right? Now, you and I know that means that the stock's hard to borrow, correct?
Yeah.
So
you can't do the other side.
Do the other side of the reversal or whatever you're doing. So yeah. So people, in order to be able to get that stock to borrow, if you can borrow some, you're going to make so much money on the reversal that people are now paying for the short stock, right, instead of the other way around. So you and I might say, I'll pay you 3% a month because I'm making $2 on the trade I can now do because now I'm hedging I wasn't before, right?
Yeah.
Now, does your class, if I were to go there and say that, would I get some head boppers?
You'd get a lot of head boppers.
Well, there you go.
And I'm not bad-mouthing the class or anything. It's just nobody in my derivatives class right now works in the financial bits.
They're learning just to get the theory and so forth, right?
Well, that part, but they're learning some of the things that you do in the corporate space using derivatives.
Okay, because people used to use derivatives. There were options on land going back hundreds of years, right? Same thing.
There was who had to work for 7 years to marry somebody's daughter, and then he had to work another 7 years to marry another daughter. Those were options.
Yeah,
I forgot what book that was.
Yeah, but what with the who paid the upkeep on the daughter?
I have no idea. I assume the father.
Oh God! So if they have bad teeth or something, he's paying for the dentist or something.
Yeah.
New outfit.
Yeah.
Oh God. So what classes are you teaching? Are they fun ones? The derivatives got to be.
I'm teaching derivatives, and I'm teaching in the medical school. I'm teaching doctors about how to run small businesses.
Wow, that's got to be interesting.
In case they want to run a practice. Yeah. There are classes that the med school students that med school is not in June and July basically. So okay. There are, if they want to do alternative things during that period of time, and one of them is they could actually get I think a physician MBA along with their med school degree.
Wow.
So those are the people that are taking that class right now. It's like we're doing an awful lot in a short period of time, but it's also, you know, these guys' summer break. So,
do you guys have a...
So get a lot of, oh gosh, I was flying and I forgot to turn that in. You know?
Well, do you guys have any other combo courses when I ask that? I mean, at the University of Chicago...
We're launching a MBA in biotech in the fall.
Do you have, this going back a ways, but Chicago had... MBA was 2 years, law degree was three. If you did them combined, it was four, and you got both. Do you guys have a...
Get your JD MBA.
Do you guys have one of those?
I don't think we do.
That's odd, because that was like the first one.
Yeah, well, and I think, I don't think we do, and the reason I don't think we do, I think the law schools in Indianapolis and the, you know, and Kelly's based in... It might be something like that. We got just about every type of degree you can think of. I'll bet we've got some sort of JD MBA.
How much?
And I just don't know it.
How much of
I'm
the?
I'm not a good person to ask about the programs since the school is so freaking big and there's so many of them.
Well, what's the strategy behind your MBA program? When I ask, University of Chicago was you had to do 20 classes no matter what. Now 11 of them were supposed to be in the MBA school, and the rest you could take electives. Of course, if you were downtown, you really couldn't get the Hyde Park to do the electives, but I was fortunate enough to go full time in Hyde Park, so I placed out of my two economics classes because that was my major. So I only had to take 9 of them really in the business school. And I could have taken all the entire other 11, and I would probably couldn't have been med school. I'd have flunked, but I could have taken them in law school. I could have taken them in history. I actually took like 7 or 8 in economics. That's how I landed Milton Friedman and George Stigler and those guys. Those were all economics classes. They weren't in business school. Now, my brother Dan, when he went to DePaul, he already had a CPA. So he didn't have to do any of his accounting classes. Now, the number of classes there were 20. I think he only had to take 12, 13, 14. He just never had to take them. He didn't have to substitute them. Something out of Chicago, if you placed out of all of them, you had to find some place to take 20 classes. They weren't letting you out. So there were two different... Now, what is the strategy at your place? If you place out, is it one less you have to take, or you just got to take something else?
I don't think you can place out. I think there's a standard format, and then elect it like in your first year, and then the second year you have a variety of electives to choose among.
I would bet that if...
And they're all business classes.
I would bet that if somebody comes in with his CPA, they're not going to force him to take entry-level accounting. He has to take something harder.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, they probably make them take something harder, which I guess gets you there. But yeah, that's how I hit all these guys. I mean, I had one, the two quarters that I took a history economic thought, that was in the economics building. I told you, you know, it was in my class, Steve Schwartz. What a character that guy was, or is.
Oh, that's funny.
You ever meet him?
I have, yeah, a long, long, long time ago.
Is he still with us?
I'm not sure. I can't remember the last time I saw anything out of him.
Yeah, I can't either.
And it's like 20 years ago for me.
What's we got a minute or two here. There's some of the stuff that Kevin and I and Mike were talking about. If you were gonna get together with a group and say, okay, how can we deal with this budget deficit? It has to be kind of a three-pronged approach, I think. A little bit on the taxation. I don't think you want to raise it for regular people. I think I would raise the corporate rate, and I would make dividends tax deductible. So I'd So a lot of these corporations would have to sprinkle that money around if they're not using it, rather than just keep it. I think that makes sense from several different levels. I think you need to get more people working and get this participation rate up 2 or 3% somehow. And I think you got to cut some expenses somehow. And
so you have
to. And you have to reel in this medical industry. You can't be paying that kind of money for stuff that isn't worth that much. When I say it doesn't cost that much to make, I mean, but how do you get anywhere near those three approaches when it seems to me they're so logical? I mean, that's where the spending is. This is where the money is. I mean, and I think you got to stop stuff like basis workup on stocks. Although I don't like the capital gains tax the way it is. I think it should be indexed. So let's just, I think you agree with all four of those things. How does somebody put those on a platform and say, this is what we're going to do? Does it make sense?
When Trump got elected in 2016, I stepped up and wrote a whole thing. And, they had a place that you could submit information if you'd like to work in the White House. And fixing some of the things within the financial system, like you're talking about, were the things that I thought maybe he might... that the administration might be excited about. I've never heard a peep back from them on it. I don't think I'm going to apply again if he gets elected.
Well, Carl has worked his way up into some of the, he actually saw some people's aides in Washington during his career, and they didn't want any part of his stuff either, even though he was trying to help them out. I mean, I don't know if they, either they already know. Matter of fact, he told me he had one group that said, we already know this stuff. I mean, he was telling about how the medical, line of expense was going to bury him in 5 years. They go, we don't know this stuff. We don't need you to tell us.
Yeah, okay. We know that. There's nothing we can do about it.
Yeah.
We're worried about that vote in November and keeping my job. That's what I'm worried about.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
it's just a huge disconnect with incentives for politicians.
Well, how do you sit here and Stocks and Jocks, and I think we try calmly to talk about this stuff, and we sit here and we go, God, we're over our GDP. By the way, Russell, how come it appears that the national debt is higher than our GDP? If you look at some of the ratios, it's a little less. Does the national debt somehow include debt from like one government agency to another? Is it overstated?
I think there are some parts of the debt or obligations of the federal government that they almost treat like off balance sheet items.
Well, there's that.
I think Social Security is one of those.
Right.
Even though there's a Social Security shortfall, that's not being reported. It's because that's like a social insurance program. It's separated out, and that's why you'll hear different figures with respect to. What the national debt is as a percent of GDP. Well, there's things they exclude from it that probably shouldn't be excluded because things the federal government's going to have to take care of.
Because just as a, I'm looking at the national debt is roughly $35 trillion. Okay, and the domestic product is 28.5, call it 29. So even you and I can figure the debt seems to be over the domestic product, right? Yet,
yeah.
If you look at the world debt clock in the U.S., they've got us same numbers, 35 and 28. But if you look at public debt to GDP ratio, it's only 90%. And it looks to me like it should be like 108 or something, or 110. But how do
that
you?
That might be. Well, see, that right there might be where that 35 is. I mean, I'm just doing this off the top of my head, but that 35 might be counting Social Security and Medicare, and then the public debt number is the number that excludes those.
Okay. Now,
that's I do know that they're, again, well, the other part of it is total public debt could include non-federal.
I don't think it's total. I think it's U.S. But I'm saying, now, you and I are we're not trying to be the town crier, but if you look down the page here, you've got Japan at 13.5 national debt, 4.5 GDP. So they're 300%. Now, you and I are sitting there going, hey, us at 100 is pretty awful. you got to do something. Somebody might look up there and say, looks to me like Japan's doing fine and they're three times as much. What's the matter with you two bozos? I mean,
yeah,
is it,
sure. I mean,
because they've kept their interest rate down to 1%, and you and I are sitting there going, wait a minute, you know, we have a problem. Mike was just on talking about, if you look at the components of this, the total debt defense, our spending on defense is $910 billion, and our interest on debt is up to $901 billion, so it's closing. If you look at the numbers spinning, the interest number is spinning faster than the defense number. If all of a sudden this 10-year rate goes to 6 or 7,
if we get another spike in inflation, you know, if we start to see some numbers that look inflationary, it looks like they didn't completely conquer it. And those are a couple of big ifs. Your 10-year prediction is not going to be all that silly.
All right, one final question. We got to go. Can they, the people that, let's say they're not cheating on the CPI, let's say whatever, let's say they're timing issues, whatever it is. Let's not even talk about the hospitals, but the home numbers and the rent numbers for the last 4 or 5 years, virtually everybody, you know, Case Shiller, all those people, have been saying home prices are up X, rents are up X, and the number is usually like twice as much is in the CPI. Now, my question is, suppose the prices don't go up at all the next 5 years, are those raises going to percolate their way through the CPI, or they'll never come through?
Yeah.
You think they will eventually come through?
Yeah. Yeah. We had the first bout of inflation, then we got got a lot of groups that were able to score some pretty nice raises. And you got to pay for them somehow.
Well, what I'm saying is, 1 year, the rent, Case Shore rent index was like up 21%. The CPI had it up 10. Now, okay. Now, did they lie? Was it a timing difference? I don't know. You know, I'm not about to call everybody a crook and a liar, but although we have at times. Now, the question is that 10% like a boogeyman in the room, and it's going to come through some year when the rents don't go up at all, or is it just forgotten and never going to come through?
I think there's just going to continue to be a disconnect.
Mm-hmm. Well, have a good weekend. Are you knocking on the neighbor's doors for this dog because you don't want her to go too far?
Yeah, I'm just walking around the neighborhood going, adopt this dog.
You'll put a little sign on her.
Yeah. So.
God.
No, she's a cutie.
How old?
She's like 2 years. And she was abandoned and malnourished and stuff, so she didn't grow to be very big. She's like a tiny, she's like an old person tiny dog. Little lap dog.
Are you pointing a finger at me here? What are you doing?
No, I'm not pointing. I'm just saying that it'd be a perfect dog for an old. You were talking about, what was your father-in-law, dogs never leaving?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Same visualization there. The exact same thing.
There you go, bud. SP Futures down 52. NASDAQ Futures down 27. You have a great week. Talk at you next week, buddy. Buy a winning lottery ticket or something and remember me.
I will.
All right. We'll be back tomorrow. Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.